I have longed for thee, and now I pray to thee, save me from Poseidon's threats. Pity a homeless man. Even the immortal gods might pity one who comes, as I come now, to thy stream and thy knees after much tribulation. Have mercy upon me, Lord, I throw myself upon thee. Then the river stayed his flowing, and held back the wave, and made calm before him, and brought him safe into the mouth. He sank on his two knees, and let his strong arms fall, for the sea had worn him out. All his body was swollen, and the salt water bubbled from mouth and nostrils. Breathless and voiceless, he lay in a faint, and awful weariness overcame him. When his breath came back by and by, and his spirit rallied again, the first thing he did was to unwind the goddess's veil. He dropped it into the river as it ran murmuring seawards, and the swell carried it back until Ino quickly received it into her kind hands. Odysseus crawled up out of the river and sank down on the rushes and kissed Mother Earth. Then, deeply moved, he spoke to his own brave heart. "And now what will become of me? What will be the end of all this? If I keep watch all this wretched night by the riverside, I think hard frost and drenching dew together may be too much for me after that fainting fit, and the wind blows cold towards dawn. If I should climb the hill into the dark forest and lie down in a clump of bushes to have a good sleep and get rid of this chill and weariness, I am afraid I may be just something for wild beasts to eat and play with." But after thinking it over, the last plan seemed the best. So he entered a coppice which he found close to the river, with a clear space round it. There he crawled under a couple of low trees which were growing close together out of one root, a wild garden olive and a blackthorn. So thick and close they grew that no damp wind could blow through, nor could the sun send down his blazing rays, nor could rain penetrate. Odysseus crept into this thicket and found there was plenty of room for a bed, so he scraped up the leaves with his bare hands, for there were plenty there, enough to shelter two or three men in the wildest winter weather. Imagine the delight of Odysseus when he saw this place, after all his troubles. Down he lay in the middle and heaped the leaves over his body. So there was Odysseus lying under the leaves, like a smouldering brand which someone has buried under black ashes far away in the country, with no one living near. That is how he keeps the seed of fire, or else he would have to go elsewhere for a light. And Athena shed sleep upon his eyes, and closed the two eyelids, that he might quickly rest from his weariness after sore tribulation. Book 6. How Odysseus appealed to Nausicaa, and she brought him to her father's house. So there he lay in his thicket, worn out and heavy with sleep. But Athena made her way to the Phaeacian town. Formerly this people had lived on the plains of Hyperia, near the savage Cyclopians, who did them great damage, being stronger than they were. Afterwards they migrated, led by their great king Nausithous, and he settled them in Scheria, far from the world of men who earned their bread in the sweat of their brows. Nausithous ran a wall round the city, and built houses, and made temples for the gods, and divided the fields among the people. But by this time he had yielded to fate and gone to Hades, and the king was now Alcinous, a man full of inspired wisdom. To the house of Alcinous, Athena made her way, with her grey eyes glinting, as she planned the homecoming of Odysseus. She entered a splendid chamber where the king's daughter lay asleep. That was Nausicaa, a girl tall and divinely beautiful, and in the same room were two attendants, graceful girls, one beside each doorpost. The gleaming doors were shut. Like a breath of wind, Athena passed to the girl's bed, and, stooping over her head, spoke to her. She had made herself look like the daughter of that famous seaman Dymas, a girl of her own age and her particular friend. In this shape, Athena spoke. Why are you so lazy, Nasikia? And with such a mother as you have, there is all the fine linen lying soiled, and it is high time for you to marry. You will want a nice frock, then, for yourself, and the same for your wedding company. That is the kind of thing which gives a girl a good name in the world and pleases her father and mother. Let us go out and wash the linen as soon as day dawns. I will lend you a hand myself that you may get it done quickly, for you will not remain a maiden long. You have plenty of admirers, the finest young men in all the nation. Get up and persuade your good father as soon as the morning dawns to get ready the mules and a wagon to carry sashes and robes and sheets all glossy and shining. Better for yourself to drive rather than walk, for the washing tanks are a good way off from the town. When she had said this, Athena sped to Olympus, where, as they say, is the gods' abiding place, unshaken for ever. There are no beating winds or drenching rain, no snow falls there, but the clear sky spreads cloudless. Over it a white radiance floats. There the blessed gods are happy all their days. To that place went Athena when she had spoken to the girl. In a moment there was Dawn on her golden throne, and Nausicaa in her dainty robe awoke. She was excited by the dream and went straight through the house to tell her mother and father. She found them indoors. Her mother sat by the hearth with her attendant women, twisting the purple yarn. Her father she met just going out to attend a council of the chief princes to which she had been summoned. She came close to him and said, "Daddy, dear, couldn't you let me have a good big cart with plenty of room? Because I want to take our best clothes to the river and give them a wash. They're all lying in a dirty heap. You know what is proper for yourself when you are with their worships, passing resolutions. You must have clean clothes. And you have 5 sons in the house, 2 married and 3 spruce young bachelors. They always demand everything fresh from the wash when they are going to a dance, and only my poor brains to manage it all." That is what she said, for she was too shy to mention her happy dreams in her father's presence. But he saw through it and answered at once, "Take the mules and welcome, my child, and anything else you want. Go ahead, the servants shall get you ready a good big cart with plenty of room and a tilt over the top." Then he called to the servants and gave his orders. They got ready the mule cart outside and fitted it upon a fine set of wheels and brought up the mules and yoked them in, and a housemaid brought a handsome cloak from her chamber and laid it in the cart. Her mother packed a hamper full of eatables, everything the heart could desire, and plenty of it, not forgetting the meat, and a goatskin full of wine. Then the young girl got into the cart, and her mother handed her a golden flask of olive oil to use after the bath with her attendant women. Then the girl picked up the whip and reins, shining with polish, and whipped up the team. The mules went rattling along and did not shirk the pull. So on went load and lady together, but not alone, for the maids were trotting by her side. In due time they reached a noble river. The washing tanks were there, never empty, for the water came bubbling up and running through them, enough to cleanse the dirtiest stuff. There they took out the mules and let them go free, driving them down to the eddying stream to browse on sweet clover. Then the maids unloaded the wagon and carried the clothes into the deep water, where they trod them out in the pits, all racing for first done. And when the washing was over and all was spotless, they flew in a long string to the seashore, choosing a place where the sea used to beat upon the beach and wash the pebbles clean. There they bathed and rubbed themselves all over with olive oil. After that they took their meal on the river bank while they waited for the clothes to dry in the sun. When they had all had enough, both maids and mistress, they threw off their veils and began playing at ball, and Nausicaa led the singing, with her white arms flashing in the sunlight as she threw the ball. She looked like Artemis when, bow in hand, she comes down from the mountains over lofty Taygetus or Erymanthus to hunt the boars and fleet-footed deer. Round about her the nymphs make sport, those daughters of Zeus who frequent the countryside. And her mother is proud indeed, for she lifts her head and brow above all the troop, and she is preeminent where all are beautiful. So shone the fresh young maiden among her girls. But just as she was about to yoke the mules and fold up all the fine clothes and set out for home, Athena decided that Odysseus should awake and see the lovely girl and let her take him to the city. So then the princess threw the ball to one of the maids. The ball missed the maid and fell in the eddies, and they all shouted at that. The noise wakened Odysseus, and he sat up and began to think,
What next, I wonder? What sort of people live in this land? Violent, savage, lawless, or kindly men who know right from wrong?
I seem to hear something like women's voices, the cry of girls. Perhaps they are nymphs. There are plenty of them on the mountains. The dells and springs and brooks are full of them. But these seem to be using human speech. Well, I'll just go and see.
So saying, he crawled out of the bushes. He broke off a branch, thick with leaves, and held it before him in his hand to hide his naked body. Then he strode along like a lion of the mountains, proud of his power, who goes on through wind and rain with eyes blazing, as he pounces on cattle and sheep or chases the wild deer. Indeed, he is ready to follow Belly's bidding and to invade even a walled close in search of the bleaters. Odysseus felt just as desperate when he resolved to join a party of pretty girls without a rag upon him, but he could not help it. What a vision they saw! Something filthy and caked in sea salt, which fairly terrified them. Away they scampered in all directions to hide behind hillocks of sand. Only the young princess stood her ground, for Athena took all fear away. So she halted and stood firm, and Odysseus was uncertain what to do. Should he throw his arms round her knees and crave mercy of the lovely girl, or should he stand where he was and ask her politely to give him some clothes and to tell him the way to the city? When he thought over the matter, it seemed best to stand where he was and to speak politely and quietly, in case he might give offense to the girl by embracing her knees. He lost no time, but spoke to her in gentle and persuasive words.
"I kneel to thee, queen. Art thou goddess? Are you mortal? If you are a goddess, one of those who rule the broad heavens, I would liken you most to Artemis, the daughter of Zeus Almighty, so tall and beautiful and fair. If you are a mortal, and one of those who dwell upon earth, thrice blessed are your father and your gracious mother, thrice blessed are your brothers. Their hearts must be warm for your sake when they see such a fresh young creature tripling over the green." But most blessed beyond all these in his heart of hearts is he who shall come laden with bridal gifts and take you to his home. Never in all my life have I seen such another, man or woman. I am amazed as I look upon you. In Delos once I did see something like you, a young palm spire springing up beside Apollo's altar. For I have travelled even so far, and there were many others with me on that voyage, which was to bring me so much tribulation. Even so, when I saw that sapling, my spirit was dumbfounded for a long time, for no other trees like that grow out of the earth. And so, my lady, I am amazed and dumbfounded at seeing you, and I am awestruck at the thought of touching your knees. But I am in deep distress. Yesterday, after 20 days on the dark sea, I escaped. All that time sea and storms had been carrying me away from the island of Ogygia, and now fate has cast me ashore here. No doubt I am to suffer more troubles here. I do not think the gods will give over yet, for they have much to work off on me still. Pity me, queen, I pray. To you first I appeal, after so much misery. Not another soul do I know of all those who live in this country. Show me the way to your town. Give me a rag to cover me, some wrapper you may have brought with you for the clothes. And may the gods give you the dearest wish of your heart, husband and home, and one heart between two. For nothing is better and more precious than when two of one heart and mind keep house together, husband and wife. That is a sight to make their friends happy and their enemies miserable. But they know it best themselves. Nausicaa stood her ground and replied, "Stranger, you do not seem like a bad man or a foolish man, but happiness is something which Olympian Zeus above allots to men, whether good or bad, to each according to his will. Your fortune is what he has given you, and you must endure it in any case. But now that you have come to our country, you shall not lack for clothes or anything else which it is proper that any forlorn wanderer may have for the asking. I will show you the way to town, and I will tell you what this nation is called. This is the country of the Phaeacians. I am the daughter of Prince Alcinous, their king and ruler." Then she called to her maids and said, "Stand still, my girls. Why do you run off at the sight of this poor fellow? You don't think he's an enemy, do you? There is no man living upon the earth, and never shall be, who would come into the Phaeacian land to do harm to its people, for they are dear to the immortals. Our home lies far away in the sea, out of sight of land, at the end of the earth, and no other mortal men visit us. But here is a poor homeless man, and you must look after him. God sends the stranger and the beggar man. We gladly give, not much, but all we can. Come along, girls, give this stranger something to eat and drink, and a bath in the river where he can find shelter from the wind." The girls stood still, calling to one another, and then they brought Odysseus to a sheltered place, as the princess told them to do. They laid a wrap beside him and a tunic, and gave him the golden flask of olive oil, and bade him go into the river for his bath. Then Odysseus said to the maids, "Just stand a little way off, good maids, while I wash the salt off my shoulders by myself and give them a rub with the oil. It is long since my skin knew what oil feels like. I will not wash before you, for I am too shy to show myself naked before a lot of pretty girls." Accordingly, they went and told the princess all about it. Then Odysseus waded into the river and washed himself clean from the salt which covered his back and broad shoulders, and wiped off the scruff of brine from his head. When he had washed all clean and rubbed himself with oil and put on the clothes which the princess had provided, Athena, daughter of Zeus, made him taller and stronger to look at, and gave him a crop of bushy hair like a cluster of hyacinth flowers. As when a plating of gold is laid over silver by some clever craftsman who has learnt all the secrets of his art from Hephaestus and Pallas Athena, and knows how to make works full of grace, so Athena covered his head and shoulders with beauty. Then he walked away to the seashore, shining with comeliness and grace, and the girl gazed at him. She turned to her attendants and said, "Listen to me, pretty ones, I have something to say. The hand of the gods is in this. They who rule Olympus have sent this man to visit the Phaeacians, who are of their own kindred. When I saw him, I thought him an ugly creature. But now he is like one of the gods who rule the broad heavens. I only wish I might have one like him for my husband. I wish it might please him to stay here and live with us. Come, my girls, give him something to eat and drink." They hastened to obey and set food and drink before Odysseus, and Odysseus ate and drank heartily after all his tribulations, for it was long since he had had anything to eat. But Nausicaa had other things to think of. She folded up the clothes and packed them into the wagon and yoked the sturdy mules and got in herself. Then she called to Odysseus that they must be going. She said, "Now then, stranger, up with you, and let us go on to the town. I will take you to my wise father's house, where I promise you shall become acquainted with all the best men of the nation. But this is what you must do. You seem to have your share of good sense. So long as we are still in the country among the farms, you must follow smartly with the maids behind the cart, and I will lead the way. But when we reach the city, which has a lofty wall round it, with a fine harbour on each side, and only a narrow approach, the galleys are drawn up there along the road, and each man has a slip for his own. There is their meeting place, round about the precinct of Poseidon, and it is full of great blocks of stone bedded in the earth. There the men are busy about the tackle of their black ships, making ropes and sails and planing down their oars, for the Phaeacians care nothing for bow and quiver, but only masts and oars, and the ships with their fine lines. These are their delight as they cross the hoary sea. Well, I want to avoid any unkind gossip among the people, or someone might blame me afterwards. They are very high and mighty in our town. Some evil-minded person might say, if he met us, 'Who is this fine big stranger with Nausicaa? Where did she pick him up? will be a husband for her, no doubt. Some wandering soul she has brought from his ship. Must be a foreigner from a distance, for there is nobody near us. Perhaps she had tired out some god with her prayers, and down he comes from heaven to have her for evermore. A good job if she has gone herself and picked up a husband from somewhere else, for she only turns up her nose at the young men of our nation, who are all after her, and good men, too. That's what they will say, and it might bring me into disgrace. Indeed, I should not approve of any girl who did such a thing, flying in the face of her friends, with father and mother to teach her better, if she has anything to do with men before it comes to marriage, open and above board. Now then, sir, be quick and understand what I say, if you wish to have escort and safe conduct from my father. You will find a fine grove of Athena close to the road, poplar trees with a spring bubbling up inside and a meadow all round. There is my father's park, and an orchard full of fruit, as far from the city as a man's voice will carry. Sit down there, and wait long enough for us to get into the city and reach my father's mansion. When you think we have got there, enter the city yourself, and ask the way to the mansion of Prince Alcinous. It is easy to know it. A little child could lead you, for the other houses are not like the house of the royal Prince Alcinous. When you are within the house, you must enter the hall and pass along quickly until you come to my mother. She is a sight worth seeing. There she sits at the hearth in the firelight, twisting her purple yarn, close up to a pillar, and the serving women sit behind. My father's throne is placed near hers, and there he sits, quaffing his wine like a god. Pass him by, and lay your hands on my mother's knees, that you may see the day of your homecoming and be happy soon, even if you come from a long way off. If she is pleased with you, there is good hope that you will set eyes on your friends and come to see your own fine house and your native land. When she had said this, she touched up the mules with her shining whip, and they soon left the river behind them. Quickly they trotted along, quickly their toes went weaving, but she drove just so fast that Odysseus and the maids could follow on foot. She flicked the lash with judgment. The sun went down, and they came to the famous grove sacred to Athena, and there Odysseus took his seat. Then he prayed to the daughter of great Zeus. "Hear me, daughter of Zeus Almighty, Atrytone, hear me now at last, since formerly thou didst not hear what a blow I had when the famous earth-shaker struck me. Grant me to come among the Phaeacians as a friend, and one worthy of compassion." Thus he prayed, and Pallas Athena heard him. But she did not show herself to him face to face, for she stood in awe of her father's brother Poseidon, and he was furiously angry with the hero Odysseus until he reached his own land. Book 7. What happened to Odysseus in the palace of Alcinous? While Odysseus was praying to his guardian goddess, the girl drove her mules into the city at a brisk trot and drew up to her father's door. There her brothers met her, and fine young fellows they were. They soon unhitched the mules and carried in the clothes. She went up to her own room and found the waiting woman lighting the fire. This was the nurse of her childish days, Eurymedusa, who had been captured long ago after a raid on Epira, and she had been chosen then out of the spoil as a special prize for the king, whom the people loved to honor and obey. Soon the fire was lit and the supper coming. At the same moment, Odysseus set out for the city. A thick mist hid him from sight, for Athena did not wish anyone to meet him and provoke him or ask him who he was. But just as he was about to enter the city, Athena met him herself, in the shape of a young girl carrying a pitcher. Odysseus said to her, "My dear child, could you show me the way to the mansion of King Alcinous? I am a stranger from foreign parts, and I have come a long way, so I know not a soul in this country." Athena said, "Indeed I will, father, and welcome. My own father lives close by. But just follow me quietly, and don't look at anyone or ask any questions. People here simply will not stand, strangers. They are not glad to see anyone who comes from abroad. Ships are what they believe in, fast cutters that travel about the open sea. This is the Earthshaker's gift to them. Their ships fly quick as a bird, quick as a thought." So Athena prattled on as she led the way briskly. Not a man of them noticed Odysseus as he passed through the people along the street, for Athena had him in her care, and she covered him in a thick mist by her divine power. But Odysseus could see the wonderful sight, the harbors and fine-run ships, the people's meeting places, the long high walls with their palisade. When they reached the place, Athena said, "There is the mansion you ask for, sir. You will find the royal princes feasting away at their feast. Go in, and don't be frightened. Dogged does it every day, though you come from far away. Look for my lady first in the hall. They call her Arete, and she has the same parents as the king. You see, there was first Nausithous, the son of Poseidon Earthshaker, and the lovely Perabia, youngest daughter of Eurymedon, king of the furious giants. Eurymedon destroyed his own wild people, and he was destroyed with them. But Poseidon lay with Perabia, and their son was Nausithous, king of the Phaeacians. Nausithous had two sons, Rhexenor and Alcinous. Rhexenor was killed in his own hall by Apollo with a silver bolt while he was a young bridegroom and had no son as yet. But he left an only daughter, Arete, and Alcinous married her. Alcinous honored her as no woman in the world is honored by her husband. So she is honored still by her husband and children, and the people think her divine and cheer her loudly whenever she passes through the city. Aye, indeed, she has plenty of good sense. If her friends quarrel, she makes it up, even for men. If she likes you, there's good hope you may come safe to your tall house and your native land and see your own friends at last." And with these words away went Athena over the barren sea, and left lovely Scheria behind. To Marathon she passed, and Athens with its broad streets, and entered the strong house of Erechtheus. But Odysseus approached the great mansion. Again and again he stood still in wonder before he set foot on the brazen threshold, for a brightness as of sun or moon filled the whole place. Round the courtyard walls of bronze ran this way and that way, from the threshold to the inner end, and upon them was a coping of blue enamel. Golden doors and silver doorposts stood on a threshold of bronze, with silver lintel and golden crowlatch. Golden and silver dogs were on either side, which Hephaestus had made by his clever brain to guard the mansion of proud Alcinous. They were immortal and never grew old as the days went by. Within the hall were seats fixed along the wall on both sides, from the threshold right to the inner end, and spread over these were soft coverings of fine-spun stuff which the women had made. There the leaders of the Phaeacians used to sit, eating and drinking, for they had plenty, which never failed. Golden boys stood on pedestals of masonry, and held blazing torches in their hands, which gave light by night in the hall for the feasting. There were 50 serf women about the place, some grinding the apple-yellow grain on the millstone, some weaving their webs or twisting their yarn as they sat, all aflutter like aspen leaves on a tall tree, and there was fine close-woven cloth with olive oil dripping from it. As much as the Phaeacians surpass other men in skill to drive a swift ship over the deep, so much their women surpass in making of cloth, for Athena has granted them excellent knowledge of fine work and good intelligence. Outside the courtyard was a great orchard near the gates, 4 acres. A fence ran round it in both directions. There were tall trees in full luxuriance, pears and pomegranates and apple trees with glorious fruit, sweet figs and olives. Their fruit never fails or comes to an end all the year round, but the same west wind ever blowing buds one crop and ripens another. Pear after pear grows mellow, apple after apple, fig after fig, vintage after vintage. There was a flourishing vineyard full of fruit. One part of it was a level plot for warming and drying the grapes in the sun. In another part, grapes were being gathered. In another, men were treading. In front were unripe grapes, just shedding the bloom. Others were beginning to color. Beyond the last row of vines were neat beds of all kinds of garden stuff, ever fresh and green. There were 2 springs of water. One was led in rills all over the garden. The other ran opposite under the threshold of the courtyard and came up near the high house. From this, the townspeople used to draw their water. Such were the gods' glorious gifts in the palace of Alcinous. There Odysseus stood gazing after all his tribulations. When he had taken it in, he crossed the threshold with brisk steps and entered the hall. He found the lords and rulers of the Phaeacians dropping the libation out of their cups in honor of Hermes Argifontes, whom they used to honor the last of all before they went to rest. Odysseus passed through the hall, hidden in the mist which Athena spread about him. When he came up to Arete and King Alcinous, he threw his arms about the knees of Arete, and in a moment the mist faded away. All fell silent throughout the hall when they saw him, and they stared in surprise while Odysseus put his petition to the queen. "Arete, daughter of divine Rexenor, I come in my distress a suppliant to your husband and to your knees. Yes, and to those who sit at meat, may the gods grant them to be happy while they live, and may each have children to inherit his wealth and the honorable place which the people has given him. Now I beseech you to send me home to my native land without delay, for I have long suffered tribulation far from my friends." This said, he sat down upon the hearth in the ashes beside the fire, and silence fell upon all. At last a noble old man spoke, Echeneus, one of the elders of the nation, a notable speaker, and one who knew well the traditions of ancient days. In kindness and friendship he spoke. "Alcinous, it is not right and proper that a stranger should sit on the ground amid the ashes of the hearth, but we must all wait for you to speak first. Come now, sir, take him by the hand, and raise him up, and lead him to a seat of honour. Bid the ushers mix wine, and let us pour our drops to thundering Zeus, who is always beside a suppliant to win him respect, and let the housewife give the stranger food." There they were, face to face, the king in his majesty, and the castaway, with only his knowledge of man and his ready wit. Alcinous held out his hand to Odysseus, and led him from the hearth to a high seat where his own son was sitting near himself, for he loved the courteous Laodamas best of all his sons. He moved his son out of that seat and placed Odysseus there. A servant brought the hand wash and poured it from a golden jug over a silver basin to rinse his hands, then set a table beside him. A dignified housewife brought bread and laid the table with all sorts of food and plenty of it. Then the strong man ate and drank after all his troubles. Meanwhile, the king called to an usher.
"Pontonous, mix a bowl and serve all who are in the hall, and we will pour our drops to thundering Zeus, who is always beside a suppliant to win him respect."
So Pontonous mixed the honey-hearted wine, and went round the company, pouring the first drops into their cups, which they then poured out on the ground. After this they drank what they wanted, and Alcinous addressed them.
"Listen to me, my lords and princes of the nation, and let me tell you what I think. You have finished your feasting. Now go home to rest, and early in the morning we will call the older men to a full meeting and entertain the visitor in my hall. We will offer a handsome sacrifice to the gods, and then we will consider his send-off. We must escort him home without trouble or annoyance, and bring him to his native land in contentment without delay, even though it may be far off. On the way, we must see to it that he meets no hurt or misfortune until he sets foot in his own country. But after that he will have to suffer whatever his lot may be, whatever the stern spinners spun off their thread for him on the day when his mother brought him forth. Or, if he is one of the immortals come down from heaven, then we may take it that this is something new in the gods' dealings with us. For in times past they have always been in the way of showing themselves to us face to face when we perform our solemn sacrifices, dining with us and sitting among us in the same place. And even if some solitary wayfarer meets them, they make no concealment, since we are very near akin to them, like the Cyclopians and the savage tribes of giants.
Odysseus answered readily, "You need not be anxious about that, Alcinous. I am not at all like the immortals who rule the broad heavens, either in stature or feature, but I am just a mortal man. Those men whom you know most ridden with affliction would be most like myself. Aye, indeed, I could tell you of more sorrows than theirs, which I have borne from first to last by the will of God.
Well, now, let me dine, in spite of my troubles, for there is nothing in the world more shameless than this cursed belly forces a man to remember it in spite of dire distress and sorrow of heart, such as the sorrow which is in my heart. Yet the belly commands me to eat and drink and makes me forget all that I have suffered and bids me fill it up. Do your best, I pray you, early tomorrow, that an unhappy man may return to his own country after so much suffering. Let me once set eyes on my lands and my men and my great house, and then let me die.
Excellent, they all said. Couldn't be better put. We must see our visitor safely home.
Then they poured out their last drops, and when they had drunk all they wanted, they went home to bed.
Now Odysseus was left in the dining hall, and beside him sat Arete and King Alcinous. The attendants cleared away the trappings of the feast. Then Arete asked him a question, for she had recognized the fine tunic and the wrapper which he wore as soon as she saw them. She had made them herself with her women, and now she came to the point at once.
"Now, my guest, I will ask the first question myself. Who are you, and where do you come from? Who gave you these clothes? Didn't you say you had been drifting about on the sea?"
Odysseus answered readily,
"A hard task, my queen, to tell the whole story of my troubles, since the gods who dwell in heaven have given me many, but I can answer this question easily enough. There is an island called Ogygia, lying far away in the sea. There lives the daughter of Atlas, the scheming witch Calypso, with her lovely hair, a terrible being. No one ever visits her, neither god nor mortal man. But I was her guest, unhappily, as fortune would have it, all alone, for Zeus had struck my ship with a fiery thunderbolt and smashed it to pieces on the dark sea. Then all my companions were drowned. But I straddled across the ship's keel and tossed about for 9 days. On the 10th black night, the gods brought me to Ogygia, where beautiful Calypso lives, and a terrible creature she is. She rescued me and treated me kindly, loved me and fed me, and promised to make me immortal and never to grow old all my days. But she could not win my heart. There I remained 7 long years on end, and the imperishable clothes which Calypso gave me were always wet with my tears. But when the 8th year rolled round, she told me to go in a hurry, some message from Zeus, or perhaps she had changed her mind. She sent me off on a raft which I put together, and gave me all sorts of things, bread and delicious mead, and imperishable clothes which she had woven, and sent behind me a warm, soft wind. 17 days I sailed over the deep. On the 18th appeared the shadowy hills of your land, and glad my heart was to see it. But bad luck was still to come from Poseidon Earthshaker. He drove the winds against me and barred my course and stirred up the infinite sea, so that the waves would not let me get on, and there I sat despairing on my raft. Then the tempest broke it to pieces, and I went swimming across yonder gulf until wind and water drove me near to your coast. If I had tried to get ashore there, the waves would have crushed me against the face of the cliff and dashed me upon the rocks in a most unpleasant place. But I sheered off and went on swimming until I reached a river, which seemed to me a good place to land, with some shelter from the wind and no jagged rocks. I was thrown up gasping for breath, and night came on. Then I got away from the swollen river and sank down in the bushes, where I scraped up the leaves over me, quite worn out, and God let me fall into a deep sleep. So there, under the leaves, I slept all night long, and through the dawn, past midday, sunset hour was coming when sleep left me. Then I noticed your daughter's maids playing about on the beach, and herself with them, like some goddess come down from heaven. I made my prayer to her. She had no lack of good sense. Indeed, she had such as you would not expect a young person to show. The young are thoughtless, one and all. She gave me bread enough and sparkling wine and a bath in the river, and she gave me these clothes. There is the true story of an unhappy man. Alcinous answered,
"I will say this, sir. My girl did not show good sense at all, that she did not bring you home with the waiting maids.
You appealed to her first, after all.
Odysseus had his answer ready. My lord, do not blame your girl for that, I pray you. It was not her fault. She did tell me to follow with the maids, but I would not. I was afraid, and bashful, too, in case you might be offended to see me there. We men that walk the earth are a touchy generation.
Alcinous answered, Sir, I am not the kind of man to be put out for nothing. It is better to have everything done fairly and squarely.
I could wish,
if only you would grant it, Father Zeus and Athena and Apollo, I could wish that you, just as you are, with such sympathy between us, would agree to take my daughter and become my son and stay here. I would give you house and estate, if you would stay willingly. For against your will, no one of our nation will keep you. Father Zeus forbid. Do not be anxious. You shall have an escort, and I will fix the time for tomorrow. Then you shall just sleep soundly while they row you over the calm sea, until you reach your native land and your home, or anywhere you like, even if it be farther off than Euboea, which our people say is the most distant place there is, those who saw it when they took golden-headed Rhadamanthus to visit Tityus, the son of Gaea. They went there, let me tell you, and did the journey without trouble, and came all the way back on the same day. You shall see and know for yourself that my ships and my lads are the best in the world to splash up the brine with their blades.
Odysseus was glad indeed to hear this, and he prayed aloud and said, Father Zeus, may Alcinous do all as he has promised. Then his fame would be spread over the whole earth, never to be extinguished, and I should come home to my native land.
While they conversed in this manner, Queen Arete directed her maids to prepare a bed under the open gallery, to lay upon it fine purple blankets with coverlets, and to provide fleecy wraps for clothing. The maids went out of the hall, torch in hand, and when they had done their task, and the bedstead was ready, furnished, they came to Odysseus and invited him to go.
Come now, sir, your bed is made.
He was quite ready, and glad at the thought of rest. And so Odysseus slept after all his troubles. But Alcinous lay down in a recess of the lofty hall where his lady prepared their bed, and lay down by his side.
Book 8. How They Held Games and Sports in Phaeacia.
As soon as the first gleams of dawn appeared, King Alcinous sprang out of bed, and up rose Prince Odysseus. Alcinous led the way to the Parliament Square by the quay, and there they sat down on the seats of polished stone, side by side. Meanwhile, Pallas Athena took the form of the king's herald, and went up and down in the city to arrange for the convoy of Odysseus, and to every soul she met she spoke and said, "This way, lords and princes of the nation, to Parliament, and you shall hear about the stranger who has lately come to the palace of your wise king, after long travel on the sea, a man who seems like a visitor from heaven." This made them all eager and curious to hear. Soon every corner and every seat was full of the gathering people. Crowds were there, gazing at the stranger. Great dignity was about his head and shoulders, and he looked taller and stronger than before. This was the grace of Athena, who wished that all beholders might fear and respect him, and that he might be ready to do the many feats which the Phaeacians tried him with. When they were all there, Alcinous addressed the assembly.
"Lend me your ears, my lords and princes of the nation. I have something which I wish to lay before you. The stranger beside me, I do not know who he is, has come in his travels to my house, whether from the east or from the west. He asks us to help him on his way and begs for a sure promise. Then we, as our ancient manner is, must help him on his way. That is a matter of course, for no one who comes to my house has ever to complain of delay as far as that goes. Very well, we will launch a new ship, and choose 250 of our best oarsmen. Sling the oars ready beside the thwarts, and then come ashore, and you shall find a meal ready for you in my house. I will see about that, and there will be plenty for everyone. So much for the lads. You, my lords, all who are here, come up to my house now, and we will entertain our visitor. I will take no denial.
and send for the minstrel Demodocus. There is no one like him to make us merry if he is in the mood to sing. A divine gift, that is, indeed.
So the king went home with the princes, and a herald summoned the minstrel.
250 picked men launched the ship and put mast and sails aboard, and ran the oars into the leathern thole slings, all shipshape. Then they hoisted the white sail and moored her in deep water. This work done, they made haste to the palace. All the open galleries, all the courtyards and rooms were full of men. Alcinous had killed a dozen sheep for them, and 8 tusker boars and 2 oxen. These were skinned and got ready, and the cooks prepared a most inviting meal. Now Pontonous the herald arrived with the minstrel. This man was the muse's darling, but she had given him evil mixed with good. She took away the sight of his eyes, but she gave him the lovely gift of song. The herald placed a chair of state for him against a tall pillar, and hung up the well-tuned harp on a peg over his head, guiding his hand to touch it. Then he set out a table beside him with a bread-basket and a cup of wine upon it, in case he wanted a drink. The guests fell to, and when they had had enough, the spirit moved the minstrel to sing the stories of famous men. He began with that lay which had already become famous all over the world, the quarrel of Odysseus with Achilles, how they wrangled with hot words at a banquet, and how King Agamemnon was delighted, and this was the reason why. Before the war began, when the storm clouds were beginning to roll up over Trojans and Danaans by the ordinance of Zeus, Agamemnon had visited the sanctuary of Pytho to inquire of Apollo. And the god had told him that the best men of the army must quarrel, and then he would take the city of Troy. He thought this was the quarrel, and so he was glad. So this was the song the minstrel sang. But Odysseus, when he heard it, caught up his purple robe in his hands and drew it down over his head, hiding his face, for he was ashamed to let the company see the tears in his eyes. Whenever the singer paused, he would wipe his eyes and throw back his robe and pour out a few drops to the gods from his cup. But the diners enjoyed it too much to let the singer stop, and as soon as he went on, Odysseus would cover his head again and give way to sorrow. No one noticed him but Alcinous, but he was sitting next to him and saw what he did and heard his groans. So at last he spoke.
"Look here, gentlemen, we have had enough of our feast now, enough of banquets, bosom friend the harp. Let us go out and try our luck at games and sports, that our friend may report to his friends when he gets home how we beat the world at boxing and wrestling and jumping and running."
At this hint they all got up and went out after him. The herald hung up the harp on its peg and led out Demodocus after the others.
All made haste to the ground, and a huge crowd followed, thousands of them. Young champions were found in plenty, top ship and quicksea and paddler, seaman and poopman, beacher and oarsman, deep sea and lookout, go-ahead and upperboard. There was Seagirt, the son of many clipper shipwrightson. There was Broadsea, the very spit of bloody Ares himself, and Admiral Tydes, the finest man in stature and strength after the admirable Laodamas. And there were the 3 sons of Alcinous, Laodamas and deep-seed Halius, and Clytoneus of naval renown. The first contest was a foot race. The running was fast from scratch to finish. They went tearing along over the course all in a bunch, except for Clytoneus. He was far and away the best, and beat the field by the breadth of a mule's day-work on fallow land. Next came wrestling, and Broadsea won. At jumping, Seagirt was first, the rest nowhere. Paddler was easily first at putting the weight, and in the boxing, Laodamas, the king's son. After that good sport, Laodamas said, "I say, you fellows, let's ask the stranger what he has learnt of games in his school days. He's not bad to look at. Good thighs and calves, and a good pair of arms on him, a strong neck, hefty, and not too old. But he's broken down with hardships. I declare there's nothing worse than the sea to wear a man out, however strong he may be." Broadsea answered, "Excellent! You go and make the proposal. Challenge him yourself." So Laodamas went forward and said to Odysseus, "Come along, father. Have a try at the games yourself, if you ever learnt them. A man ought to know about games. Game is the best way to fame when you're still alive, what you can do with your arms and legs. Come along, have a try. Be gone, dull care. You haven't long to wait now. Your ship is afloat and the crew ready." Odysseus answered, "Why do you say that, Laodamas? You are all making fun of me. My mind is more set on troubles than on games. Suffering and sorrow is what I have had so far. I am here in your gathering only as a suppliant to your king and people, and all I want is to get home." But Broadsea thought he would get a rise out of him, and said, "Ah, well, sir, I would not put you down as a fellow who goes in for games, though that is the way of the world, you know. Skipper of a trading crew is what you look like, plying with a broad hooker, thinking of cargo, keeping an eye on the goods, and grabbing what profits you can. You certainly have not the look of a sportsman." Odysseus said with a frown, "Sir, I do not like your way of speaking. We know the gods do not grant all the graces to any man, handsome looks and good sense and eloquence together. One man is not much to look at, but God crowns his words with beauty, so that all may listen to him with delight. He speaks in a steady voice, with winning modesty. He is notable where men gather together, and as he walks through the streets, all gaze upon him as one inspired. Another, again, may be handsome as a young god, but there is no crown of grace upon his words. So you are as handsome as God could make a man, but your mind is empty. You have made me angry by your bad manners. I am no duffer in sports, as you say, but I think I was among the first when I could trust in my youth and my hands. Now I am tired and worn out with perils in battle and perils of the sea. Well, never mind that. I will try my hand. You have cut me to the quick, and I cannot sit still any longer." He sprang up, cloak and all, and seized a huge, big weight, far heavier than any the young man had been using, and with one whirl round his head, he cast it strongly. The stone went whizzing through the air, and all the stout seamen standing by crouched down as they felt the wind of it. Over all the marks of the others it flew like a bird. The man marking the throws was really Athena, and she called out, "A blind man could find your mark, stranger, by fumbling. It's a long way out of the crowd. You need not worry. No one will reach it, much less beat it." Odysseus was pleased to find a real friend on the ground, so he said gaily enough, "Touch that if you can, young men. If you do, I think I'll follow it up with another as good or better. Has anyone else a mind for something? Out with you, then, and take me on. You have put my back up, and I don't care what it is. Box, wrestle, run, anyone you like, except only Laodamas. He is my host, and who would fight with a kind friend? I call that man a good-for-nothing fool who would set up to rival his host at a game in a foreign land. He is ducking his own tail. Anyone else, I say, no one barred. Anyone is good enough. I'll try a bout with him, man to man. I'm not a bad hand at any game that's going. I know well how to handle a smooth bow. I can pick off my man first out of the enemy ranks, if there are heaps of my comrades shooting at the fellows. Only one man beat me before Troy with bow and arrows, and that was Philoctetes. As for all the men who now eat bread on the face of the earth, I say I am better than any of them. But not the characters of ancient history. I should not care to match myself against Heracles, or Eurytos the Achaean, who dared to stand up to the immortals. That is why Eurytos never lived to grow old. He challenged Apollo to a shooting match, and Apollo was angry and killed him. As for javelins, I'll throw one as far as you can shoot an arrow. I am afraid of nothing but the foot race. Someone might beat me there, for the sea has been too much for me. There is no great comfort aboard ship, and my sinews are all slack." All were silent at this, but after a while Alcinous spoke for the rest.
"My dear sir, you do not offend us by your frankness. You are quite right to stand up for yourself when someone sneers at you, as this man did. You make it quite clear that no one who can talk sense could ever question your powers. But now
Let me say a word, please. We are anxious that you should take away a pleasant memory of our performances. We have our own powers, you know, which Zeus graciously gave to our fathers, and they handed down to us. When you are at home again and sitting at dinner in your hall with your wife and children, we hope you will remember us and tell them the story. The truth is, we are not first-rate boxers or wrestlers, but we are fine oarsmen and the best of seamen. Our delight is in feasting, in music and dancing, plenty of clean linen, a warm bath, and bed. Come now, out with the best of our dancers. Let our friend have something to tell his friends when he gets home. How we beat the whole world at shipwork and footwork, dancing and song. Fetch the harp, someone. Off with you, on the spot, and give it to Demodocus. It is somewhere in the house.
No sooner said than done. Away went the herald to fetch the harp. The stewards appeared, 9 men appointed to be masters of the ceremonies. They cleared the ground and made a good tidy ring. Then the herald brought the harp for Demodocus, and he stepped into the middle. Groups of blooming boys circled about him, footing it round and tapping the ground. Odysseus was fairly amazed to see their twinkling feet. The harper struck up a tune and sang the loves of Ares and Aphrodite. He told how first they lay secretly in the house of Hephaestus himself. Ares brought her many gifts and dishonored the bed of Lord Hephaestus. But before long, Helios the sun came and told him that he had seen them lying in a loving embrace. Hephaestus heard the cruel tale, and straight to the smithy he went with a plan of vengeance in his heart. He set the great anvil on the stand and forged chains that could not be broken or loosed to hold the pair immovable. When he had fashioned this net for Ares in his hot anger, he took it to the bedchamber and fastened the meshes over the bedposts and down from the roof beams, network fine as a spider's web, which no eye could see, not even the blessed gods themselves, a masterpiece of clever work. As soon as he had draped the cunning net to perfection, he made as if he were going to Lemnos, for he loved that noble city best of all. But Ares kept no blind man's watch. He saw the master craftsman going away. He made haste to the house of the famous smith, eager for the love of garlanded Cytherea. She had just come in from almighty Cronion, her father, and there she was, sitting in the house when he entered. He clasped her hand and said, "Come, my love. Let us to bed and take our joy. Hephaestus is not in the place, but I think he is gone already to Lemnos, to hear the barbarous talk of those Cincians." She was filled with joy at the thought, and they lay down on the bed. Then the craftsman's clever net closed round them, and they could neither move nor lift a limb. At last they knew there was no chance of escape. Hephaestus was close by all the time, and now he came hobbling along. He had turned back before he came to Lemnos, for Helios had been on the lookout and told him what had happened. He stood in the doorway with fury in his heart. He roared aloud and called to the gods, one and all. "Father Zeus and all you blessed gods who live forever, come this way and see a fine joke, an intolerable piece of impudence. Because I am lame, this daughter of Zeus, this Aphrodite, forever treats me with contempt. She loves this murderous Ares because he is handsome and has 2 sound feet on him, and I was born a cripple. Why blame me? It was my parents' fault, not mine, and I wish I had never been born at all. But you shall see where the loving pair are sleeping, on my own bed. It makes me sore to see that. Well, I don't think they will care to lie like that one little minute more, fond lovers though they are. Before long they won't want to sleep, neither one nor the other. But there my ingenious arts will keep them. Until her father pays back my marriage gifts, every jot, all I paid for the sake of this bitch, because she was a pretty girl. But she does not know how to behave herself." At this call the gods crowded up to the smith's house. Up came Earthshaker Poseidon, up came Hermaeus Erianthus, up came Apollo, prince of archers, but the goddesses were too modest and stayed at home. There stood the dispensers of all blessings at the door. A roar of unquenchable laughter rose from the blessed gods to see the skill of Hephaestus the master craftsman. You might have heard them say to one another, "Honesty is the best policy. Slow catches quick, as now slow old Hephaestus has caught Ares, the quickest god in Olympus. The lame dog wins by his wits. Now there's damages due to a cuckold. Amid this kind of banter, Prince Apollo, son of Zeus, said to Hermes, "My dear Hermaeus, son of Zeus, king's messenger, dispenser of blessings, would you like to sleep with golden Aphrodite and have that strong net smothering you close all round?" King's messenger Argifontes answered, "I only wish I could, my dear Lord Apollo, prince of archers. Wrap round me three nets like that, with no way out. All you gods look on, and all the goddesses too. I would sleep with golden Aphrodite." The gods burst into laughter at this. Only Poseidon did not laugh, but just begged the famous craftsman to let Ares go. "Let him go," he said. "And I give you my word, as you ask, that he shall pay all that is justly due in the presence of the immortal gods." But the famous Crookshank god answered him, "Do not ask me that, Poseidon Earthshaker. Go bail for a cheat, and he'll cheat you out of your bail. How can I put you in the net if Ares gets out of net and debt together?" To this Poseidon Earthshaker made reply,
"Hephaestus, if Ares gets out of his debt and shows a clean pair of heels, I will pay you the debt myself."
Then the famous Crookshank god gave answer, "I cannot, and I must not, refuse your offer." So Hephaestus, angry still, undid the net. Once free from the inextricable bonds, the two were off like a shot, he to Thrace and she to Cyprus, smiling broadly, away to Paphos and her temple and altar of incense. There the Graces bathed her and rubbed her with oil divine, such as the deathless gods refresh themselves with, and they clothed her in lovely garments, a wonder to behold. So sang the famous singer. Odysseus was delighted as he listened, and no less that whole nation of seafaring men. Alcinous next told Halios and Laodamas to dance alone, since no one wished to compete with them. So they took in hand a fine purple ball, one of the clever works of Polybus. One of them would bend his body backwards and throw up the ball into the clouds. The other would jump high and catch it lightly in the air before his feet touched the ground again. After throwing it straight up in this way, they danced on the level ground, throwing the ball one to the other again and again. The lads beat time, standing round the ring with clapping hands. At this, Odysseus said to Alcinous, "My lord Alcinous, you boasted that your artists of the dance were the best, and here it is really before us. I am amazed at the sight of them." This delighted the royal prince, and he called out at once to the company,
"Do you hear that? My lords and gentlemen all, our guest seems to be a man of mighty good sense. Come now, let us give him the stranger's due as is right and proper. We have 12 distinguished princes who rule over our people, 13 with myself. Each of you, bring him a mantle newly washed, and a tunic, and a nugget of fine gold. Let us make haste and get these together, that our guest may have them in hand, and go in happy to his dinner. And Broadsea must make his peace with a gift and an apology, since he was rude to him just now."
The princes applauded this. Each did his part and sent his marshal to fetch his gifts. Broadsea, too, said,
"My lord Alcinous, surely I must make my peace with our guest as you bid me. I offer him this sword of bronze with a silver hilt, and a new sheath of ivory to hold it. This ought to make amends for a good deal."
Then he placed in the stranger's hand the sword with its knobs of silver, and said simply,
"I salute you, father. If I have blurted out an ugly word, may the winds carry it away. May the gods grant you to come safe to your native land and see your wife, after all your long sufferings, far from your friends."
Odysseus answered, "I wish you well also, my friend. May the gods give you happiness, and may you never miss the sword which you have given me with this handsome speech." Saying this, he slung the sword over his shoulder. The sun went down, and the gifts were all there. The servants carried them in, and the king's sons laid the magnificent gifts before their honored mother. Soon the others came in, led by Alcinous, and took their seats. Then Alcinous said to Arete,
My dear, bring out the best coffer we have, and lay in it a newly washed mantle and a tunic. Warm a copper over the fire and get hot water for him to bathe. After that he may see all the gifts of our excellent princes laid neatly out, and have a good dinner with music and song. And I offer him this goblet of wine, a real beauty, pure gold, that he may remember me all his days, as he pours the sacred drops in his hall to Zeus and all gods. Accordingly, Arete directed her women to set a large tripod over the fire at once. They put a copper over the blazing fire, poured in the water, and put the firewood underneath. While the fire was shooting up all round the belly of the copper and the water was growing warm, Arete brought out a handsome coffer from her room and laid all the gifts in it, clothes and gold which had been collected, and she added a mantle and a fine tunic, and said to Odysseus, "Look to the lid yourself and fasten it quickly, that no one may do any damage on the way while you are sleeping soundly on board ship." Odysseus at once fitted on the lid and fastened it up with an intricate knot which Circe had taught him. Then the housewife told him his bath was ready. Glad, indeed, he was to see the warm water, for he had had little comfort since he left the house of beautiful Calypso, but there he was treated right royally and lived like a god. So the woman bathed him and rubbed him with oil and put a tunic and a fine robe on him, and he passed from the bath to the feasting company. As he went in, by the doorpost of the hall stood Nausicaa, looking as lovely as if she had stepped down from heaven. She gazed with admiring eyes at Odysseus, while she said, "I wish you a happy voyage, sir, and I hope you may sometimes remember me when you are in your native land, since you owe me first the ransom of your life." Odysseus answered, "Princess Nausicaa, the Sea King's daughter, if only Zeus Thunderer will grant me once more to see my home and my native land, then be sure I will ever remember you in my prayers, for you gave me life, dear girl." He passed on and found his seat by the side of King Alcinous. They were already serving out the portions and mixing the wine. A marshal led in Demodocus, their excellent minstrel, whom the people honored. He placed his seat in the midst of the guests, with its back to a tall pillar. Then Odysseus called to the man, as he cut out first a piece of boar's chine, which had been given to him, and more was left behind with plenty of fat on both sides. "Here, marshal, take this to Demodocus, and give him my kindest wishes. For in every nation of mankind upon the earth, minstrels have honor and respect, since the muse has taught them their songs, and she loves them one and all." The marshal took the slice and set it before Demodocus, who accepted it with great satisfaction. Then they all fell to. When they had eaten and drunk as much as they wanted, Odysseus called out, "Demodocus, I commend you above all mortal men. You must have been taught by the Muse, the daughter of Zeus, or by Apollo, his son, for you sing only too well the fate of the Achaeans, all they did and suffered, and the hardships they went through, just as if you had been there yourself, or heard it from one who had. Now change the tune, and sing the contrivance of the wooden horse, how Epeius made it with the help of Athena, and Odysseus brought it into the citadel by way of stratagem, full of the men who sacked Ilion. Then, if you tell the story aright, I will declare at once to all the world that God has been generous to you and inspired your song." Then the inspired minstrel delivered his song. He began where the Achaeans embarked in the fleet and sailed away after setting fire to their encampment. But by that time the illustrious Odysseus and those with him, hidden in the horse, were in the marketplace of the city, for the Trojans themselves dragged it into their citadel. There stood the horse, there stood the people all round, doubtful what to do. Three plans found some favor: to break up the wood with axes, or to drag it away and cast it down from the rock, or to leave it as an offering to appease the gods. This last plan was taken in the end, for it was their fate to perish when the city should admit that great wooden horse, with all the best men of the invading host within it, to bring ruin and destruction upon Troy. He sang how the sons of Achaea left their lair and poured out of the horse and lay waste the city. He sang how they went this way and that way, sacking the place. And Odysseus came to the house of Deiphobus, like another god of war, along with royal Menelaus. That was the most dangerous of all his battles, so the minstrel said, and won after all by the help of Athena. So sang the famous minstrel. Odysseus was melted, and tears ran over his cheeks. He wept as a woman weeps with her arms about a beloved husband who has fallen in front of his people, fighting to keep the day of ruin from city and children. When she sees him panting and dying, she throws her arms around him and wails aloud. But the enemies behind her beat her about the back and shoulders with their spears and drag her away into slavery, where labor and sorrow will be her lot, and her cheeks will grow thin with pining. No one else noticed his tears, but Alcinous saw clearly enough sitting by his side and heard his sobs. At once he called out to the company, "Listen to me, my lords and gentlemen. It is time for Demodocus to quiet his harp. Not everyone is pleased by the song. Ever since he began to sing at this supper, our guest has been grieving. His heart must be full of sorrow. Well then, let the man stop, that we may all be merry, host and guest alike, which is much the best thing. All this has been arranged in honor of our guest, food and escort and friendly gifts, which we offer in goodwill. Stranger or suppliant stands in a brother's place to any man who has a touch of good feeling. And you too, sir, don't be so reserved. Don't try to hide what I ask you. Speak out is the best thing. Tell me what name you go by at home, what your mother and father call you, and the people of your town, and your neighbors all around. No one on the whole world is without a name, high or low. His parents give him some name as soon as he is born. Tell me your country and people, and your city, that our ships may aim at the right place in their minds. For we Phaeacians have no pilots. Our ships have no steering gear like other ships, but they understand of themselves the thoughts and intentions of the seamen. They know all the cities and countries in the world, and cross the gulf of the sea at full speed, hidden in clouds and mist. There is no fear they will ever come to harm or be lost. I will tell you what I heard from my father, Nausithous. He said that Poseidon would be jealous of us one day, because we give safe convoy to all. One day, he said, Poseidon would smash one of our ships coming back from convoy in a fog, and he would throw a high mountain round our city. So the old gentleman said, God can do it or not do it as it shall please him. Now, tell me all about your travels, what countries you have visited, what cities of civilized men. Tell us who are savages and lawless men, who are hospitable and God-fearing. And tell us why you are so unhappy when you hear the fate of Argives and Danaans and the fall of Troy. All that was the gods' doing, their thread of destruction which they spun for men to make songs for future generations. Perhaps a kinsman of yours died before Ilion, some good man and true, your good son or your good father, who come closest to us after our own blood. Or perhaps a friend, a man dear to you, a good man. For a comrade and a decent fellow is indeed no less than a brother. Book 9. How Odysseus Visited the Lotus Eaters and the Cyclops. Then Odysseus began his tale. "What a pleasure it is, my lord," he said, "to hear a singer like this with a divine voice. I declare it is just the perfection of gracious life, good cheer and good temper everywhere, rows of guests enjoying themselves heartily and listening to the music, plenty to eat on the table, wine ready in the great bowl, and the butler ready to fill your cup whenever you want it. I think that is the best thing men can have." "That you have a mind to hear my sad story and make me more unhappy than I was before. What shall I begin with? What shall I end with?
The lords of heaven have given me sorrow in abundance. First of all, I will tell you my name, and then you may count me one of your friends, if I live to reach my home, although that is far away. I am Odysseus Laertiades, a name well known in the world as one who is ready for any event. My home is Ithaca, that bright, conspicuous isle, with Mount Neriton rising clear out of the quivering forests. Round it lie many islands clustering close, Dulichion and Same and woody Zacynthus. My island lies low, last of all, in the sea to westward, the others away towards the dawn and the rising sun. It is rough, but a nurse of good lads. I tell you, there is no sweeter sight any man can see than his own country. Listen now. A radiant goddess, Calypso, tried to keep me by her in her cave and wanted me for a husband. Circe also would have had me stay in her mansion, and a clever creature she was, and she also wanted me for a husband, but she never could win my